my view and the consensus view is that like we definitely have hit a new kind of cultural level of sophistication in tabletop games that's probably not going to go away regardless of whatever happens next. The tabletop games industry has been growing double digits over the past 5 years, I think, and Kickstarter tabletop has been growing at the same rate. So it is wonderful. It is kind of sustainable. Like in games in particular, it's not a very hit driven economy. There's actually a very good churn of small creators and, you know, new people coming in and creating a new creative life for themselves, which they can then use to sustain their career for hopefully the next like 10 or 20 years.
Hi, I'm Jamin Warren, and this is the 256 Podcast. 256 is a marketing agency that prepares brands for the future of play and interactivity. We spend a lot of time talking to clients and partners about games, and so we thought, what if we brought more of those conversations to more people? Even if you're not in the gaming space, this podcast is for you. We bring in guests for quick, insightful conversations on how and why games are more relevant than ever, in culture, but also in marketing. Hopefully, you'll walk away with a better understanding of why play matters. When I say games, you'll probably think of video games. That makes sense. The big hits like Fortnite and Apex Legends get a lot of media attention. But there's a whole other type of game that we shouldn't forget: tabletop games. That term might not sound familiar, but you've definitely played one of these before. Board games, card games. Basically, a tabletop game is any game that you need to play on a flat surface, like, say, a tabletop. And today, we're speaking with an expert on the topic, Luke Crane, head of games at Kickstarter. Since 2009, Kickstarter game projects have brought in $1 billion. That's right, $1 billion with tabletop games, making up 69% of the pledges. Full disclosure, and a little bit of a sidebar, my agency 256 can be traced all the way back to a Kickstarter campaign in 2009. We self-funded a magazine called Killscreen that focused on video games. 256 is the agency side of Killscreen, and the names are connected. In 8-bit video games, like Pac-Man, level 256 has a bug that floods the screen with numbers and letters so that you can't play past it. That's what makes it a Killscreen. Get it? All right, now on to our guest. Why do you think games, and more specifically tabletop games, have been so popular on Kickstarter?
You know, there's a lot of reasons. There's no one thing. Or if there is one thing, it's because Kickstarter sits at the confluence of a bunch of other kind of cultural rivers. And we've just been very lucky to be a part of this real cultural shift in terms of how people play games and how people make games. So, you know, the fact that Kickstarter is a rewards-based funding platform is really beneficial to tabletop games. It means that a creator can say, hey, I want to make this game, and you are going to get a copy, and I'm going to ship it to you. It's not conceptual there. You know, it may be conceptual the first few times, but then, you know, Kickstarter has developed this very virtuous cycle where there is a community of people now that come to Kickstarter looking for new games from new creators because they know that, like, this is where the cutting edge is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just really unique, and it just doesn't exist for, you know, any other creative medium in the same way.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. How are successful creators like marketing their Kickstarters to people, particularly in the gaming category? And maybe how is that different from how creators in other categories maybe get the word out about what they're trying to do?
I mean, there's some tried and true methods and, you know, some kind of basics of, like, it's a web-based platform, so you need to think about if your audience is on the web. I mean, we've had, you know, kind of veteran creators from other industries, even from games, come and say, oh, this looks great, I want to use Kickstarter. But they can't translate their audience onto Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Their audience either, you know, they don't understand it, they don't use the web this way,
right.
You know, uncomfortable doing purchases on the web this way. They, you know, there's a variety of reasons. So the, you know, the tried and true way is like that your audience is on the internet and that you, it's worth stating the obvious, and that you have access to them in some way. This is also something that frustrates me, is that a lot of people who have had careers in the games world don't actually have access to their audience. Like, they mm-hmm. haven't taken that audience with them from game to game to game. They, you know, because they didn't have the luck to be a celebrity or something like that. But they're like really influential creators or people that have made dozens of games that folks love, but no one knows who they are.
Right.
So this is something I'm always looking for when somebody comes, if they have a pedigree, do they have access to their audience? Or if they're a new creator, like, have they been building their audience? Like, what's the community like? Do you have access to this community? Does this community want to use Kickstarter to support your project? And the kind of the answers to those questions will guide how I will kind of give best practices and advice to a creator.
Hmm. One of the interesting things to me about Kickstarter is that there are two sides to the equation, where it's both supporting people who create, but then also people who ultimately like purchase and back. I wanted to ask, like, how does your language shift when you're trying to make a pitch for Kickstarter as a platform to people who make games versus your pitch to people who want to be a backer someday?
So internally at Kickstarter, we have two main newsletters. We have what's called Projects We Love, which features just a few projects a week. And then we have this thing called Happening, which features more projects per week, but in kind of a lower profile format. You know, Projects We Love goes out to millions of people. Happening goes out to hundreds of thousands of people. So those are big channels. And a few years ago, I said to the folks that ran those newsletters, I was like, can I have one? I want a newsletter for games, because like Kickstarter as a brand is amazing, and the work that they have done to create the idea of Kickstarter like in the brains of culture is just really incredible. But what they do doesn't really speak to folks who play games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I want to talk directly to my audience. And eventually I got this. And now I've even hired Trin Garitano away from Cards Against Humanity to be that voice. Like, she's our digital outreach specialist for games. She's in charge of like the newsletter or Twitter, any kind of like communications we're doing out from games. She's in charge of that voice, because we take this idea of these categories, right? Of these different disciplines of creativity, of music or film or dance or games. We take that very seriously. It's important to recognize that each of those communities talks about itself very differently, talks amongst itself very differently. But just the fact that like the games world on Kickstarter has adopted things like add-ons and stretch goals. I actually don't think the games people invented these, but they have certainly refined them to this incredible degree. So basically these are hacks on the platform that allow creators to sell a la carte items, or allow creators to create this illusion that all of the quote unquote extra money for the game is being put toward, you know, enhancing the game experience or adding new content and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's the same impulse. That's the creators recognizing it's not just about watching the dollars go up. They need to be talking to the people who are supporting them. They need to be feeding them with the, like, exciting, like, internet party style atmosphere. Right? Like, this is what I tell creators. Like, it's, you're going to throw a 30-day party on the internet. What are you going to do? You can't, like, you can sit there and go yay and throw confetti on the first day, but you have 29 more days. What are you going to do? And for creators, you know, we roll up our sleeves and say, okay, how do we do that? How do we communicate with them? How do we show them your good works so that they get excited about it, so they want to share it with their friends?
Yeah, that's complicated. I think, you know, there are opportunities there. And so, you know, a company has to figure out, like, or they have to negotiate kind of like where people are, and also a very large community. Games are both perceived as being niche, but then also huge, right?
Yep.
Could you tell me a little bit about maybe how the marketing for like the tabletop community differs from the marketing of like a video game itself? Aside from the fact that, you know, in one case you have a digital object and in the other you have a physical one, how do those creators maybe talk differently? How do they interact with backers? Are there differences between the way those two different projects like ultimately get out to the public?
You know, at a high level, they both use digital marketing resources. They both use newsletters. But one of the main differences that you're going to see on a tabletop games project versus a video games project is a box. Tabletop games, tabletop games people, creators and backers love boxes. You know, the consumer, the backer has become much more sophisticated, and it's not just like the you know, they want to see the box, but now the box has to be full, like packed. Like, there has to be so much stuff. Like, I got like the first wave of the Joan of Arc by Mythic Games, and it's at work still. I don't know how I'm going to fit this box in my house. It's it's a box full of boxes, and the boxes are full of like plastic miniatures. But that's one of the other places where Kickstarter has really shined in a way that I just never like never really anticipated, you know, but I saw it happening. And obviously like a good video games creator will show you the art or, you know, the animations and things like that and give you this kind of intimate look of the characters that you probably wouldn't get unless you're doing like kind of a behind the scenes thing. And that just has never existed for board game creators until Kickstarter, because the project page is this incredible resource to zoom in really close to the components, not only to show off the art that's going to go in the game, but to show the models, to show the dice, to show all this stuff, and to show it like, you know, in this kind of larger than life way that you just don't get to see. Like if you're looking at this game on a store shelf, you don't get this view of the game. And creators do this on Kickstarter. They understand it. They understand the value, the impact of showing these, honestly, these beautiful components, these really artfully done components. And, you know, Kickstarter gives them that platform to show them off to the backers.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I guess along those lines, like for people outside of Kickstarter, are there things that you think that maybe people outside the gaming space could learn from the way that the tabletop community has, you know, essentially like marketed what they do? Is there like some key learnings there that you think like, oh, this is probably universally an understanding of like how people interact with something physical that could be applied in other places?
Yeah, right. Like there are obviously limitations to the physical space of board games and, you know, tabletop games. You know, when you place that game on your table, it's not going to look like it looks on the Kickstarter page. Mm-hmm. And I see, like, especially like early days, there's a lot of like these like flash photography shots of like of handmade prototypes like sitting on the living room floor. I would lose my shit when I would see these. I was so excited. I'm like, yes, that's it. That's game design. but in terms of like getting someone excited about what you're doing, you have to really take a step back. You have to take this a very imaginative step back and think like, how do I like draw them into my fantasy world? How do I like make them feel like, you know, they're in the forest with me and we're moving slowly from tree to tree and there it is, there's the, you know, the dragon or whatever. So yeah, you have to kind of dive into a skill set of visual storytelling on the project page that, you know, is something separate from everything else that you're doing, you know, the material design, the game design, all that stuff. Like the way you present on the Kickstarter page is different. And so yes, so I do think that other creative media could learn from Kickstarter tabletop games creators and think about like how to really evoke the feeling, the fantasy, or whatever it is that they're doing.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about the audience. You know, who's buying board games? What are their motivations? You know, any surprises that you've seen in terms of like what that audience like ultimately looks like?
One of the things I'm really proud of Kickstarter is that we have resisted and have foregone tracking any kind of demographic information for our backers.
Oh, cool.
We don't log it. We don't take it in. We don't keep it. You know, it used to really frustrate me, you know, early days. I was like, but I need to know. And then, you know, one of the head of the data team sat me down at one point and said, hey, this is actually really difficult and dangerous information for us to keep a hold of and, you know, probably not worth it. And I was like, oh, huh. And now with the state of the internet in 2019, I'm like, oh yeah, totally. Do not keep people's private information that you don't need. So right, so anything that I'm going to say here is purely anecdotal. One thing that I've seen in tabletop games is, you know, obviously it's not a monolithic scene, there's not a monolithic culture, but really one of the things that kind of identifies them all is that they're folks in their like mid to late 20s into their late 40s, early 50s, who have jobs, families, careers, whatever, and they have kind of a stable life and a disposable income. I mean, I know that may seem obvious, but we're not talking on the most part like teens. We're not talking about college kids,
right?
Like those are two traditional markets where you see, you know, a lot of kind of mega corporations like looking to get their hooks in there and, you know, oh, gotta get the teens on the Instas. and for Kickstarter, like we're talking about a little more settled audience, and
which I think in a lot of ways, like that belies the perception. I just, when I talk to people more generally, like about games, I think the perception is like, oh, the person who plays games, like Fortnite, for example, where the perception is like, oh, well, my kids play Fortnite, ergo, everyone who plays video games must look like my teenage son or daughter, as opposed to saying like Fortnite is a very large subset of this much larger group,
right,
of which, you know, they are akin to that person who grew up playing Fortnite in the same way I grew up playing Doom and Quake and those games. That person becomes someone who's going to be looking to do game nights with friends, or, you know,
right,
has some friends that they made online playing World of Warcraft, and, you know, now they want to get together and play like a tabletop role-playing game or something like that. I think people have a hard time kind of like seeing,
yep,
like the longer term behavioral trend about who plays games. They sort of think of games as being this thing that happens at one point in time in your life and then you never play games ever again.
Right.
As opposed to like,
right.
You know, I'm a grown man. I like playing board games.
Yeah.
And we'll continue to do that forever.
Right. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I mean, I've been preaching that exact same story with this idea that, like, yeah, of course, the impact of like home computers and consoles in the late 70s and, you know, into the mid 80s, like, obviously this was a tectonic cultural shift. It's huge. But one of the things that it did is that it like realigned the perceptions of what it meant to play games,
mm-hmm,
and that games were something that you could play alone. Games were something that you could play with the family. Games were something that could be bright, colorful, full of beep boops, or they could be something that you pulled down from the board game shelf, blew the dust off, and you know, played for 8 hours on a Saturday. And this is where Kickstarter is really benefiting from this, is that like this audience, not only are they sophisticated in terms of their like playing habits, they're sophisticated in their buying habits. Like, they're interested in interacting with creators, that, you know, they want to be a part of this experience. They value novelty. They also value complexity. Like, mm-hmm, you know, the difference between like the type of games that are produced on Kickstarter versus like something that a big publisher will produce like Hasbro, these are worlds apart.
Mm-hmm. All right, Luke, thank you so much for your time, man.
Great. Thanks.
And thank you for listening to the 256 podcast, where we talk about the future of play and interactivity. This podcast is produced by Trisha Tonko with help from Anthony Martinez and music by Lucene. If you like this show, tell your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen. I'd also love to hear from you. You can find me, Jamin Warren, on Twitter at JAMINWAR. You can also find 256, that's also spelled out, on Twitter and at 256podcast.co, where you can sign up for our newsletter. Thanks so much and take care.